I'm Jason Mundock, and this is Around the Wood Stove. Our mission is to encourage the arts in, around, or because of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Pittsburgh-based singer-songwriter Heather Kropf, along with bassist and producer Randy Venturini, stopped by the Woodstove House to chat about Heather's 2009 release Hestia and the challenges of life as an independent musician. They were in Lancaster to showcase at the 2010 Launch Music Conference. More information about Heather's music can be found at heatherkropf.com. That's HEATHERKROPF.com. Hestia, you mentioned, was a record that maybe fits more or reconciles more with your live performance. And it's the one I'm most familiar with.
Yeah.
I read an interesting thing about the idea behind that and the word and where that came from. Can you tell that story?
Sure. So the origin or the genesis of Hestia for me was in college, where one of my friends sort of poked her head in the door. I was sitting somewhere and she's like, "You're like Hestia." And I'm like, "What is Hestia?" And she said, "It's the goddess of the hearth and home." And I guess I must have been sitting in a lounge by a fire reading a book or doing my homework or something. And it was an offhand comment. And then I came back to this Greek goddess's story and became kind of interested in it a couple of years ago. I don't have any idea why, but I just sort of looked her up, and a lot of her attributes really matched a lot of sort of what I see my attributes being when I'm just sitting at a piano and just playing. And so I kind of kept that in the back of my mind when I was making the record, but also when I was trying to write new songs after the last record. I was trying to think, well, how, you know, because I had gotten into a frame of thought of writing songs for more people than just me, what would happen if I tried to write songs again just for me, a piano and a voice? Like, how would, you know, like keeping it like this is the hearth, you know, this is the only place it has to be, what would that look like? So then I started trying to write songs for that, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just make a whole record of that. And thinking back, this probably should have been my first record.
Because the approach, you mean?
The approach, yeah. Because the first record, you know, on a real piano, because my songs were written on a real piano, but then I went into a studio with a keyboard.
Right.
And, you know, I think I could have, I certainly would have started ahead financially.
Yeah.
You know, but I wasn't thinking that way when I started. I was thinking of making the songs sort of the way I imagined they could be, mm-hmm. rather than the way they are. And it's, so it's sort of that, there's a spiritual component of recognizing what is here now and honoring that, which I think she kind of represents as the Greek goddess of the hearth and home. And baking. And baking. She's a Greek goddess of architecture.
Did you make bread while writing the
There was cookies. Bread rising. No.
Well, that should be the subtitle of the Hestia. The bread is rising.
The bread is rising.
Project probably was where I ended up at your website recently, like in the last in the last year. And the player, the songs that came on, Devolving, I think was the first song, blew me away.
Oh, thank you. That's my favorite song on the record.
Yeah, like that, talking about an experience.
Right.
And hearing a song that I was instantly sucked in. It was like, oh my God. And I listened to it through on the little player. Mm-hmm. Listen to a couple of the other ones, which a couple of the other songs have grown with me, you know, and I'm learning more about them and kind of experiencing them more, but mm-hmm. that particular song, boom. Mm-hmm. And
thank you.
I bought the CD from iTunes because of that song.
Okay.
So that's an example of, you know,
that's good feedback, actually.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
But that song is different.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know,
'cause that song came from experience. That was more relevant.
Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, that song was a one take. That was like after we had the session of doing the other songs with the trio, I was like, you know, George, set up the thing. I just want to use your little Wurlitzer here and play this one song that I'd written. I just get it down. But the story behind the song is I tend to do better writing when I don't have a lot of distractions at home. And the easiest way to have no distractions at home is to not be at home. So I had some friends in Boston that were going out of town and they needed some house sitting. So I thought, well, I'll just go up there and house sit and pet sit and write some songs because they have a piano there, and maybe go to a couple open stages while I'm up there and kind of check out Boston. And the first night it was the Grammys, and they had just decked out their basement into some kind of like really sweet viewing station kind of thing. And so I went up to the kitchen. I'm like, I'm gonna make some tea. I'm gonna raid their fridge for some chocolate, you know, and like hang out here my first night. And the tea was not boiling. And I was like, that's really odd. It should have been boiling by now. I went upstairs and there was already a small house fire starting. That was, you know, a kitchen fire, I should say. It was like maybe this high. And I
couple feet
high. Was more terrified than I've ever been in my entire life. And I, you know, I threw water on it thinking that was it. Well, that wasn't it. So the phone was actually around the other side of the kitchen. And I had to go kind of, yeah. So, but I knew I had to get this thing out. So I found some pans and figured I should just suck all the oxygen out, like cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then thought, okay, maybe I won't get this thing stopped. I better call 911. So I called 911, and as I was on the phone on 911, it looked like I was having success with what my attempt was with the fire. But the guy on the phone was like, get out of the house. I'm like, but I gotta get, he's like, get out of the house now. I mean, like he was telling me what I needed to do for a fire because he knew and I didn't know.
Right, and those guys I'm sure are trained for the,
right.
For the idiot homeowner, yes.
Like go.
Just yeah. go,
like
just
be run because
there's,
field.
Yeah. there's
better safe than sorry.
Smoke, absolutely. Get out of the house. So I couldn't find the cats. I mean, I didn't look, but I took the dog out. And we were on the front porch, and the fire department, man, they're fantastic. They were like there in a minute, maybe two. Right. I mean, it was immediate. These guys come in. I was ashen. It was a winter storm was like all around, and I'm sitting there my first night in Boston, like I've almost started this fire, and on this beautifully restored arts and crafts house, you know, yes, yes, and. They got it out. They're like, what? Tell me what happened. And I told them, I was like, I just put water on. And like, tell me, like, because I don't know why they kept asking me that. I'm like, I just put water on. And they're like, do you know what you did? I'm like, I just put a pot on the stove to boil water. And they lifted up this, I put an electric kettle on the stove. And the wax was melt, sure. You know, or the product underneath there, whatever. I don't know. So I had this music that I had written, and I hadn't had words, and it was one of the songs I was expecting to work on that week. I spent that night with all the windows open, trying.
Sure.
To, they said you have to air out. You have to air out.
Because it was melted. Was it melted plastic?
It was melted plastic, and the stove was like a wreck. They're like, just let it cool. It'll come off. You'll just be able to pick it off. So I wrote that song. Mostly all in one sitting that night because yeah. I'm just sitting there like I don't know what else to do with myself, but I kept playing the thing over and over and over and over and over again, and letting the house cool down. And then over the week, I spent most of the week repairing their kitchen.
For your relaxing,
your so relaxing I learned all retreat. About hardware stores and
yeah,
stove parts and so on and. Sort of fine-tuned the words over the week, but I had some other music that I had been trying to work on too that I never got to that. That's the story of devolving. I have squandered all you offer. Crank the furnace high. Open the windows wide. To wind blow cold now.
just evolving. Other days I'm still the same.
One of the other songs that has really been, I think, moving me particularly, and last night's performance of it was fantastic. It's Kite.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I thought that was, like, as far as, you know, partly because it's something that I've been listening to a lot. It's one of the songs that
was familiar to you.
Yeah, and then to hear it live, and I thought it was performed extremely well. Was there an interesting story about
There's a little story. So first of all, as an aside, that was a remake of the version on What Else Is Love.
Oh, okay.
And that was the intention of a couple of the songs, is to kind of strip them back and, you know, redo them. That story is just, the origin is based on two things. Musically, it's based on the interval called El Diablo, which is the first...
A flat five.
Mm-hmm. I heard that one point, someone playing that, and I was like, what is that? And he called it, it's El Diablo. It's the interval of the devil.
And music, yeah. They and I thought, the devil and the music.
Yeah, I thought I have to write a song with that, because...
So that's that thing that... I hear.
The she, that, you yeah, know, yeah. that thing.
She scatters seeds under a big blue moon.
So I put that in there. And then the story for the song, was a friend of mine who I lived with in college, grew up on a farm in Indiana. And I thought it was interesting to watch kind of her life story happen, where she, you know, originally had thought that her life was meant to be on the farm, take over the family farm and stuff like that. But then, you know, as she met another person in her life and then eventually got married to that person who lived in another country, and sort of the way that love kind of takes you in places that you have no idea where you're going to go. And yet there's sort of a grounding effect of that. Like there's sort of the paradox of being tied to something, but also being sort of free to kind of fly around and do different things. So that's sort of the story behind the song.
She says, I am yours forevermore. And we sit on the curb, watch the band settle the score.
Let's talk about Pittsburgh and how you got there from your native Portland.
Well, in between those two places is Elkhart, Indiana, for about 15 years.
Oh, okay.
So there's a little time in there. I graduated from college. Oh, so I grew up Mennonite, right? And there's this sort of post-college thing called voluntary service, which a lot of people who don't have any clue what they're going to do next end up doing sort of a voluntary service assignment, which is, for your audience purposes, I guess, it's like a year or two or whatever. You live in some kind of community setting and you do some kind of social giving in whatever kind of organization that needs help. So you've got this entree into probably an urban area, although there's some rural, mm-hmm. and you've got an instant community, and you've got... some kind of life purpose that's, you know, somewhat interesting. It'll put you in an environment, makes you kind of like think. So Pittsburgh started this program called Pulse, which was geared sort of like a voluntary service experience, except it was geared towards your degree. And mine happened to be in fine art. And I knew I didn't want to do some kind of volunteer experience working in a soup kitchen, because I'd done, you know, soup kitchen work, you know, here and there throughout high school, with groups of people. And I was like, you know, that's not going to actually link me to what I want to do next. So, so this program attracts artists primarily because there's not as many, you know, places for people to volunteer in the arts, and still have a place to live. So I came, my mom told me about this program because she knew the person that was starting it.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed up and came, and I worked for a little while at a silkscreen shop in a tiny suburb of Pittsburgh. And then I realized I wasn't getting connected to anybody. I was sitting cleaning little glass plates.
Right.
So I asked to switch, and they switched me to working as the assistant music director at WYUP, which is an independent AAA radio music station. And I had radio background in college. Mm-hmm. That was sort of my side hobby thing. I actually ended up with a minor in communication just because I kept signing up for stuff out of fun.
Yeah.
So that was an incredible opportunity for me because I got to, you know, see artists working. They'd come in for their live sessions. I got to drive musicians all over the place and work at shows, get into shows. I got free CDs. I sort of saw how radio promotion worked. You know, the music director had these call hours, and this is how the conversation went from his side. My job was to preview all the CDs that came into the radio station and sort of give my first recommendation.
Wow.
So I spent a lot of time listening to the stuff that we tossed, because most of the label stuff would go directly to the music director.
Right.
But then there would be a few in there that I would go, you know, this is kind of interesting. Of course, I'm coming at it from like a songwriter background, and I wanted to give everybody a chance. So I would listen to the whole thing rather than, you know, first three songs and then like, you know, it's out. But I had to screen for production value because the production value had to be on par with, you know.
And those were the days when you probably got a lot of stuff that was subpar.
That might have been subpar, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you've been in Pittsburgh then for a long time.
Yes, I moved away just for a half a year back to my parents' house so I could demo up all the songs I wanted to make for my first record and not have to worry about going to a job, and then moved back to Pittsburgh. So I've been there for probably 15 years.
Sleep this one off. Sleep this one into the dry dust. Rambunctious child. With your dreams so wild, you're gonna fly into your reflection anytime it appears.
Is Pittsburgh your sort of the place you see yourself staying?
Or? No. Huh? No, it's a funny question you ask that. Because this will be where it gets kind of ooh. We went to go see, I have to put this in here, we went to go see an intuitive astrologer together, because...
Good stuff.
It was great. I have to plug really this fun guy. Rick DiClemente is fantastic. You need to go to starself.com and check out...
Starself?
Starself.com.
Very well. I'll put it in the show notes.
And check out Rick. We both went together because we were like, we had each individually seen him for maybe 15, 20 minutes at one point, just for the fun of it.
Yeah, right.
And we're kind of stunned at how perceptive his readings were. So we went to see him, and he's just like, why are you in Pittsburgh? You should not be in Pittsburgh. You know, he's like, if you're there a year and a half from now, I'll be like really surprised. We just went like maybe a month or two ago. So yeah, he's basically told me, both times he told me, Pittsburgh is absolutely the wrong city for me to be in if I have any interest in a career of any kind, because it will fizzle out no matter what I do.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's strong.
That's really strong. He was just like, you need to be in, you know, the Northwest, Northern California, England, Turkey. You know, because there's astrocartography is what it's called. And there are these lines that line up with your chart.
Wow.
Where the plant, like sort of planetary places, according to astrology.
Right.
That,
so have you picked a place?
We haven't picked a place, but it,
we have 2 years to decide.
It makes a lot of sense that my life
we're
going
about
from,
2 years.
Yeah,
3 years.
We're about 2 years. We'll see. Yeah.
So, same thing. And you're reading.
You know what?
No, you can do okay on the East Coast. Is what he said. Yeah. But he said the East Coast is not for me.
For her, no.
right.
But England is both on our... Because
I like England and I like California, Northern California, so I'm up for it.
Who knows?
Just as long as you don't get out there and run into an astrologer who's like, dude...
Dude, you're Pittsburgh is it, man.
Yeah. The wrong place.
You should be in the burg, man.
Well, I take it.
There's this little city in the western side of Pennsylvania that you'd love. Right. I can see it in your stars.
Right.
I mean, what's your approach on sort of music as a, or the recorded song as a promotional tool versus something you sell, an asset?
Oh. Oh, that's a good question. I don't think about promotion very well to begin with, like in a big picture kind of way. So, I mean, I trade stuff with people, but I don't necessarily see my albums as my business card, because I just spent $30,000 making that record.
Sure.
So I'm not going to just give that away.
But that's the debate that's going on right now in music businesses. If you read any of these...
They say give it away. Right. Is that what you're going to say?
You try to harvest something, like an email address. Like,
but I still have an electric bill to pay.
Right.
You know, so like, how am I supposed to give everything away? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think I made some of these records maybe a little too expensively, but because I was going after something that sounded a certain way.
Right.
Or worked with certain people.
Well, the best article, I think, I don't even know if they're called articles. That's a little bit of information that came to me from the internet at one point was the Trent Reznor controversy a couple of years ago, where he made a statement about Radiohead and In Rainbows and the way that they did that.
Oh, the way they just said, mm-hmm. pay what you can.
And people hit that post and said, yeah, but dude, that's Radiohead and you're Nine Inch Nails and a million people. If everybody kicks in a buck, a million people or more are going to download that because of who you are. Mm-hmm. And you became who you are, who you are now 20 years ago.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what does the independent musician do?
Right.
And his response, which I thought was very good and very thoughtful, his response was essentially, make the record that you can afford to make without making any money back, mm-hmm. as a way to spread your word and make your money through more traditional channels like playing shows and selling t-shirts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But he said, I'll paraphrase him, but he said, there's no piece of music, there's no song that I can't get for free right now.
Yeah.
And it's true.
And it's true.
There's no song that I can't find, stream, record off of a stream, whatever. I mean, there are a million ways of doing this.
Yeah.
Let alone just using BitTorrent or whatever to get it, get an actual MP3. But I mean,
it's... So what do we do as independent artists with the expectation of earning some kind of living, even if it's just a part of it?
I think that's the great debate right now.
Because, I mean, there's so many artists...
But have independent artists ever really made money from selling albums? Yeah?
I think so. But they're
years
rare.
Years ago, I'm talking about.
No, but they're the people trend. Now.
Yeah, really make it from sales?
As opposed to what, live shows?
Live shows. Like, is the money, if you're a touring, if you're making your living.
Yeah, you're on the road.
The punk band ethic.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, weren't they really... It wasn't it always about that. I don't know. I'm kind of asking because I've never really.
So you're saying is the recorded product just the promotion for the live show? Yeah.
So as an independent artist trying to sell a record and make money off of any kind of sales, and understanding that a punk band 20 years ago maybe had their own pressing and did sell those through an independent label where they got more money, and so there was sales there, but. I still would think that the cost of, say, pressing that vinyl had to have been so great for that band. Mm-hmm. But today, regardless of what happened in 1995, because
that's gone. Right.
But, boy, that's turned on its head, right?
You know? Sure.
So what I think Trent Reznor was saying to the independent artist at that point was, if anybody can get it, you may as well give it, but don't give it for nothing.
Right.
Give it for information. and harvest email addresses. That was the message that, that I heard loud and clear. And it's it's sort of rippled through the business over the last 2 years, I think.
That makes sense.
Like, try to get an email address, try to get contact. And the other thing that he said, which was pretty interesting, was then do something special.
Right.
Like, hand make 100 copies and sell them for $50. And you and if you if you're reaching out to 5,000 people, there's going to be that fan who appreciates the handwritten or the handmade thing.
This turns the artist into a marketing professional.
It does.
Well, it's a weird mix now.
But that's what I mean, and the people who the people who do well are marketing savvy.
Right.
And the people who are just there to be artists and to express something get screwed.
Right.
Or else they love it because they're being able to express whatever they want to express. I don't know. But, like...
Yeah, it's a weird dynamic because it could be an opportunity for the artist to grow a little bit and learn how to just weave through. You only need a couple skills and then you can make a little bit of money, you know, instead of just working on your art all day, you know. I don't know. It's
but how long can you live off of 100 copies of a handmade record sold for $50?
Right.
You know?
I'm not saying...
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, but when you balance that against how much money you would make if you sold...
Regular ones.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't... I mean, that's sort of... That's where I get...
I mean, just because that his opinion or that an opinion that is being sort of propagated out there is that you give away MP3s and you try to get people to become fans. And
no, then I
you
think that's brilliant.
Then you give those fans something special or something to see.
It's absolutely about that special thing, then.
It still leaves out the fact that it's extraordinarily hard work and that you got to figure out what the thing is that they would actually buy.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I see these, I see people around the independent scene, even regionally, who are doing creative things like trying to get people to Well, Brad, isn't he doing something where he's getting people to contribute to the to the production of his next record?
Yeah, and there are websites now that help you do that.
Yeah, right. It's like this whole idea of, like, you can be part of the project if you give me some money.
It's become sort of like a...
Like a fundraiser.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a couple websites that do that now, and I think that's interesting that that's become formalized.
But everything can become formalized. Like, it doesn't mean it's going to work.
Right.
Or that it's going to last. Mm-hmm. Because everything that happens becomes a website. Where somebody's trying, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I see Bandcamp.
Yeah.
And this, these pay-as-you-go. I mean, think about it. Radiohead single-handedly created a type of website. Because there are, like, I don't know, at least I've seen at least two or three websites now where you can sign up and offer pay-as-you-want downloads for your music.
Right. I sometimes do that at live shows, actually, where, depending on, I'll sort of read the crowd, and if I sort of feel like I might sell a CD at all, you know, by saying pay what you can, I'll do that, you know, because I'd rather, if people like what I'm doing, I'd almost rather they just go home with it for whatever they can afford so they have it and they can appreciate it rather than,
and they can tell other people that they appreciate it.
So is it possible that the recorded music has become part of our marketing, a marketing line item in our budget?
Well, that's exactly, that's what we did with, what I did with Hestia was just that I needed, because I spent so much money on What Else Is Love, which was the album before, and it was a sort of a bigger studio production effort, because that's the kind of record I wanted to make, and then I realized what that actually costs on the back end of what you actually still owe. And then there's, you get locked into having to play shows you don't want to play because they pay money. And they're not because you want to sing for these people in particular or be associated with this event or venue or anything like that. It had everything to do with just like a job. And so I thought, well, I'll make Hestia and it'll just be a almost homemade record and it'll be pay as I go. No borrowing from anybody for anything, and press it in, like, you know, the little short run or whatever presses, you know, so I print 100 at a time. And they cost a little bit more, but it's like cash. I give the person cash, they print up a couple for me. I can give those away because I don't owe anybody anything for it, you know, and it's totally fine. But I don't know if it actually worked because people aren't buying it.
Why don't you think they're buying it?
Maybe that's not what they wanted. I don't know.
But they wouldn't know that before. In other words, if they're not buying it at a show, they wouldn't know. So it's not like that they... Right. It's not like that they looked at this or that they heard it because they're at a show. So they don't know that it's less produced.
No, what they heard is... I mean, there's no percussion on it. It mimics more of my live performances in that I'm generally playing as solo, duo, or trio, and less often as a full band, which is what my first two records are. So I thought, well, I'll record that and have that available for people who, you know, over the years I get some comments, not a lot, of people who say, you know, I like your albums with the band, but I really like just your live shows. And so I made that record for those people. I'm not sure where I'm going with this comment. Other than that, I made an affordable record.
But my question was...
And it becomes a marketing tool.
Did the affordable record... Is the style of record that it is the reason why people aren't buying it?
Possibly.
Were you selling most of your records at shows?
Yes.
Then they wouldn't know. Was kind of where I was going. They wouldn't know that it's a less produced record because they haven't heard it. They're just hearing your show. And they're walking over to your table and, oh, there's a CD.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they heard the produced one and heard that one and said, oh, I think I'll choose the produced one.
Well, I do tell them. I mean, I'll say if you like what you heard tonight, the album you want is Hestia. And if you want the full band, you know, radio friendly albums, you want to get Sky or What Else Is Love. So.
Right.
What Else Is Love was 2005, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder if people are buying less CDs today.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, too.
I was just going to say, I think you're taking it too personally in that nobody's buying CDs anymore.
Right.
You know, it might not be commercially viable option now because so many people, like you said, getting it off the internet.
Yeah. And so with an album like Hestia, I can give those away.
Right.
Like, that's not a loss to me at all to give that away.
Mm-hmm.
It almost seems like that the market's forcing you into this idea.
Yeah.
And maybe because that's being, again, propagated around and other people start doing it, then all of a sudden there's an expectation. That's the scary part.
That it's always going to be free?
Well, then there becomes an but isn't it really kind of that perception? I mean, think about it this way. Napster was big in 1999, right? Mm-hmm. The heyday of Napster, 2000. That's 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. So if a kid is 15 today, he was 5.
Right.
When Napster was around.
Music's always been free.
Always.
Yes. Yeah.
And the next generation of music purchasers, consumers, whatever, and even a guy who's 25 today was 15, and so he or she started getting their music at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But they'll still drop $170 to go to some big venue to see a show. Whereas when I was coming up for concerts, it's like it was only $20 maybe to go see Tracy Chapman at some outdoor pavilion
And we thought that was ridiculous.
And we thought that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden Clear Channel, I don't know who else, like tickets all of a sudden
It was the Eagles.
Was it the Eagles?
Their Hell Froze Over or whatever back in 93. It was like $90. It was the first time.
Right.
I remember, and it was the buzz. Like, I was in Nashville at the time, and the buzz was like, these guys are crazy. $90 to go see a concert,
right?
But particularly at the time, I mean, $90 was
would have been extraordinary.
But it was like,
that's a lot of
money for one ticket. So if you're going with your wife or your girlfriend or whatever, I mean, you're talking $180 plus parking and concessions.
So the people that go to these shows are believers.
So you're $225.
They're really big fans.
Yeah, they're believers in the artist.
It's where you get in the question of the value of the thing. You know, we'll go on a special date and drop $300 on a dinner. Or we could go to McDonald's. You know, it's a question of value. How much you value this experience. And people value the Eagles.
And they value...
Beatles were still around, I'd pay $1,000 a ticket to see the Beatles.
Sure.
Maybe more. You know, so we're getting into a question of value now. How much is this CD worth to me to buy, to have? Well, I can get it for free. So now...
Right. You cannot
download
standing in front of...
No.
No, you can't.
Whoever.
that's the experience that you buy.
So is it, and those artists, big artists, you know.
I can't download a steak that's made really great
and eat it
and a bottle of wine.
Right. Or get it at a drive-thru.
Yet. You know, we're not in Star Trek land yet, but yeah. So we get into a question of what is this experience? What value is this experience?
So we trickle that down to the independent musician.
Right.
It just kind of points to the live show and some experience right. that is non-downloadable.
So how right. do you, so then, so what does an independent musician do to have a ticket price that means anything? Like, where's the line? Because no one knows who, you're an unknown commodity. So people aren't necessarily going to put down $25 to see your show because they could see anybody who's on your level of notoriety for $5 at the club down the street.
I don't know exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it comes down to is this idea of doing the best live show, doing some live show that people, when they leave it, they tell everybody that they know, you've got to go see this person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I believe this for years now, that you have to tour, that you have to travel because you can't play your hometown, no matter what hometown it is, even if it's New York City.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, it's true.
Right.
You can't.
And I haven't done enough of that for sure.
You cannot play that same town.
Yeah.
Yep. Over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get into small towns, like...
People from small towns are great.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, when you come in,
When you come in, mm-hmm. it's just like a totally different experience.
Right.
Absolutely.
Than when mm-hmm. you're playing in a... Even in a city of any city of any kind. Because a small town is like the little club. That's their only entertainment. Their only live entertainment.
Even in a city as big as Lancaster, you know...
Is it like that?
Absolutely.
That's cool.
There's a buzz around when somebody's in from out of town. It's just the way it is. And
oh, that's great.
And the artists from here can go to another town even though they don't get much respect here. Well, I'm not saying that they don't get respect here. But an artist who is just drawing up and down nights. You know, you have a packed house and then you have nobody.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all this random sort of what else is going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, was it sunny today? Mm-hmm. So I was out in the yard, and so I'm not going to go see them because I can see them next month.
Right.
Or it becomes not special. Mm-hmm. But if that same artist goes to Harrisburg even, or goes to Philadelphia, it might be a bigger deal.
Yeah.
I totally believe that.
That's,
And I think as an independent artist, then, you need to somehow figure out a way to make your live show a real experience for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And then use that music as a way to spread it, I guess.
Right.
I'm not sure. I mean, does that mean that everybody that just becomes more wild and theatrical or different to try to...
Yeah, I think you're hitting on the other side of the coin, which I was thinking that you have to have a shared experience. The value is in a song that I've heard Heather produce. And I said, yeah, I felt like that one time. There's the value. Once you hit that, people will go out of their way. They'll drive across the country to have that experience again. You know,
mm-hmm.
somehow you have to get that to the people, whether it's through YouTube or MySpace. You know, somebody has to hear the song. And out of 100, you might get 5 that say, yeah, I felt like that. I had that exact same experience that you just sang about. And that's where you start getting fans and start people say, hey, check this song out, you know, because it's all of a sudden it's valuable to them.
Yeah, that song becomes the thing that they talk about when they update their status.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm listening to da-da-da because I'm experiencing this, reliving this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And traveling outside of your home area is the one thing that you can do to rise above the competition because it's harder. It's a hard thing to do.
It's harder to do.
Anything
that's
that's going to provide value is going to be harder to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? That's...
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think...
And the recorded song... It's easier to do. So the easier it becomes to record a song. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's hard to write a good song. That's what I'm...
Absolutely.
That's my point.
Yeah.
is the great song is still hard. You can't download that. You can't get a piece of software that helps you make a better song.
Some days I'm just evolving.
Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you.
And stopping
for having
by the wood stove house.
This was it's a great conversation.
Yeah, indeed.
Around the Wood Stove is a production of the Wood Stove House with inspiration from the creative works of Lancaster. Our theme song is the old-time traditional tune Buck Dancer's Choice, performed by Jeff Sims and myself, Jason Mundock. Find us on the web at woodstovehouse.com.
But the guy on the phone was like, get out of the house! Get out of the house now!